The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
The problem is that if that ruling is the D.C. Circuit, then we get round two in the Supreme Court. And, you know, even if the Supreme Court is willing to let the D.C. Circuit have the last word, I'd be very surprised if it was, that's going to take yet more time to play out.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 16th, 2023. It's another episode of Trump's Trials and Tribulations. This one recorded on December 14th in front of a live audience on YouTube and Zoom. Joining me in the virtual jungle studio was Anna Bauer, Roger Parloff, both of Lawfare, and special guest Steve Vladek from the University of Texas School of Law. We discussed Jack Smith's petition to the Supreme Court for cert before judgment on the question of presidential immunity. We talked about the court's decision to weigh in on Fisher versus United States and the potential impact on Trump's criminal cases and the other January 6th cases that involve the same statute. We talked about whether Trump's trial in D.C. will be delayed by the Supreme Court's consideration of the immunity question, the status of the civil suit by Georgia election workers against Rudy Giuliani, and we checked in to see what is new in Fulton County. We also took audience questions from our material supporters on Zoom. And to be able to submit questions to the panelists, become a material supporter at lawfaremedia.org/support. It's the Lawfare Podcast, December 16th, Trump Trials and Tribulations. Mr. Smith goes to the Supreme Court, not the D.C. Circuit. Roger, before we turn to Steve as the person who's going to make this, mingle the Supreme Court stuff with the substantive stuff here, just remind us what this case is that the Supreme Court granted cert in and why we care about it from a January 6th point of view.
Well, they took this case called United States versus Fisher. And the issue is, it's one of the two issues surrounding a key felony statute that's been used in the January 6th cases, a corrupt obstruction of an official proceeding. It's called 18 U.S.C. 1512 C2, and at least 327 January 6th defendants have been charged with it. Also, Trump has been charged with essentially two versions of it in the D.C. indictment, that charge and conspiracy to commit that charge. So it's a terribly important issue. There are two challenges. One relates to what's the conduct covered by the statute, or lawyers say the actus reus. And another challenge relates to the state of mind with which you do it, the corruptly part of it. That's called mens rea. And the Fisher case is primarily about conduct. I say primarily because one of the three judges in the D.C. Circuit that ruled on the case felt you had to really discuss the mens rea element in order to decide the case. So we're not really certain. I'm not certain. Maybe Steve has ideas. whether they're going to, the degree to which they're going to get into the corruptly element. But mainly it's about the conduct issue. And the question there is that the way the statute is written, there's two sections. I say 1512C2. C1 has to do with obstructing a proceeding or corruptly, basically tampering with evidence, destroying records or spoliation of records or altering records. And then it says, and then section two says, or otherwise obstructing an official proceeding. And the question is, the government has interpreted that second clause to mean corruptly obstructing an official proceeding. It doesn't relate to a record or a document or another object. One judge out of 15 in the D.C. District Court decided that no, that was wrong, and that word otherwise needs to have more meaning. And he interpreted as it's only obstructing an official proceeding by some other method involving tampering with evidence, basically. And that was appealed. The Department of Justice won a very narrow victory. There were three different opinions from three different judges. And what makes it really strange is that one of the two judges that voted for the DOJ purported to condition his ruling on a particular interpretation of the corruptly word. And that throws things off. The official lead opinion does not adopt that concurrence, but the concurrence, Justin Walker, in a footnote, suggests that his opinion should be the controlling opinion and not the opinion of Florence Pan, who wrote what's designated the opinion of the court.
So before we talk about the Supreme Court's adjudication of this, this has a lot of implications for a lot of January 6th, what you call the blue-collar January 6th cases. But yeah, how does it affect the Trump case?
Well, that's in dispute. Obviously, the January 6th cases, almost all of them would, that charge would be dropped because there isn't evidence tampering. The government would say, or the special counsel would say, and has said, that even if this challenge is accepted, it won't affect the Trump charges because, you know, we have allegations about the alternate elector scheme, and that involves falsifying documents. So that seems to be within the meaning of even the 1512C1. But the people arguing, at least one of the attorneys arguing one of these cases, he says, the idea here is that the obstruction has to occur by impairing the integrity of evidence. And that wouldn't make sense unless the evidence were being offered at an evidentiary type proceeding. It has to be a quasi-judicial proceeding. So even though 1512 says it applies to congressional proceedings, the interpretation would go on to say, well, that means a congressional investigation or inquiry where you're looking at evidence. And the claim is that the joint session of Congress here to certify the election, all they were supposed to do was open envelopes and count votes. And that's not the sort of evidentiary hearing that's meant. So it really depends where the court goes with this as to whether it will impact the Trump case at all.
All right. So, Steve, first of all, were you surprised at the cert grant? And what surprised you about it, if you were?
I was really surprised for two different and completely unrelated reasons. So the first, you know, what Roger Summery touches on, but which I think we should make more explicit, is these are interlocutory appeals. All three of the defendants whose cases were consolidated in the D.C. Circuit had their motions to dismiss granted, and the D.C. Circuit reversed. There hasn't been a trial yet in any of their cases. When the Solicitor General opposed certiorari in those cases, one of his major arguments was the court should let the prosecutions go forward because the government's going to be able to prove that all three of these defendants violated 1512C2 under any of those readings. So the fact that the court is granting cert now, Ben, to me, is big surprise number one, and suggests at least some real concern on the part of four or more of the justices with some feature. And we, you know, Roger already talked about there are different possibilities here of how 1512C2 has been used in January 6 cases. The second surprise is that they only granted Fisher. So, you know, in the D.C. Circuit, these three rulings by Judge Nichols in Fisher's case, in a case called Lange, and a case called Miller, had all been consolidated. It was one opinion by the D.C. Circuit that treated those three cases the same. Although all three of those defendants, you know, filed their own cert petitions, the Justice Department filed, Ben, a single consolidated brief in opposition. And even better than that, the Supreme Court's own website used its bizarre, you know, almost inscrutable internal designation to suggest that the court was treating all three cases as being consolidated. So I am surprised by both the timing that they didn't wait for these cases to go to trial and by the fact that they somehow thought to sever Fisher from Lange and Miller when it's not obvious at all to me what's materially different about those cases other than, right, two things, neither of which should explain it, right? Thing number one is who's representing the defendants in these cases, right? Fisher is represented by established members of the Supreme Court bar. The other two defendants are not. Thing number two is, you know, Fisher, Ben, factually, is different from the other two defendants in that he didn't enter the Capitol until after the joint session was over, which, you know, until after it had recessed at, you know, right before 2 o'clock. Really hard to believe that the Supreme Court granted cert to make that distinction a big one. So, you know, there's some mystery as to why they only took Fisher. And there's even, you know, more mystery to me about why they're stepping in now in this interlocutory posture.
What is your sneaking suspicion as to the explanation here? Is it just one of those head scratchers that we won't know until we see oral argument and figure out who's concerned about what? Or do you have a hypothesis as to the general contours of the likely answer here?
I mean, you know, Roger put his finger on it. There really are two structural issues in how the government has used 1512C2 in January 6 prosecutions. One is the mens rea question, which is what does it mean to corruptly obstruct or impede a proceeding? And Judge Walker's concurrence in the D.C. Circuit defined corruptly as one who acts, quote, with an intent to procure an unlawful benefit, either for himself or for some other person. Ben, if that's what the court is worried about, I think that probably doesn't throw that much of a wrench into January 6 cases if they just narrow corruptly a bit, because I think it's actually going to be relatively easy for the government to show. I think the government has shown in many of these cases that the goal of all of this was to benefit President Trump.
And third party, if I'm remembering the text right, benefiting a third party corruptly counts, right?
That's right.
If I obstruct something in order to help you become president, that's within scope, right?
As long as the benefit's unlawful, which in this case it would be, right? So it would be a violation of the Electoral Count Act, if nothing else. So if it's just the mens rea, you know, that then the timing is a real mystery, right? Because why is the court, the mens rea has not been a huge problem. If it's the actus reus, I mean, if the court is taking cert because at least four justices think that 1512C2 requires more than just general obstruction and requires some kind of evidence impairment, which is what Judge Katsas argued for in his dissent in the D.C. Circuit. That's a big deal because, you know, Roger mentioned the numbers. I mean, there are hundreds of January 6 cases that include 1512C2 charges, Ben, where I think under the majority's reading, the statute is satisfied, and under Katsas's reading, it's not. And, you know, I'm one of the folks who thinks it actually is easier to push even the Katsas view against former President Trump, you know, trying to manipulate the slates of electors, the literal physical documents that Congress was considering as part of that official proceeding seems to me to satisfy even the narrower reading of 1512c2. But for the hundreds of other defendants who have been convicted of violating c2 on this broad obstruction theory, now you'd be looking at potential retrials or at the very least, you know, resentencings if they were convicted on other charges as well.
Well, and a huge number of them would be, these would be the lead charge in a plea, right? In which they basically agreed. And Roger, you've studied this closer than anybody, but my impression is that there's a fairly large number of people who, first of all, pled out, and secondly, pled out to something where 1512C2 is the lead charge now. And so then, you know, you'd be in a just totally different place in the sentencing guidelines.
I mean, right. I think that the short version is if the court granted cert because a majority of the court wants to adopt the Katsas reading of 1512C2, then that is going to throw a huge monkey wrench into a lot of the smaller, a lot of the sort of the lower level January 6th prosecutions. And it's going to really be a mess for the district courts and for the federal prosecutors to clean up. But probably, I think, not a huge deal for the charges against President Trump, only two of which are about C2 in the first place. And where I actually think you could have an argument that those would satisfy even that narrower Katsas view.
Roger, do you have further thoughts?
I think it has to be people who want to adopt the Katsas view, because I think they would have waited. There is another case in the D.C. Circuit called U.S. versus Robertson, which is really solely, tried to be solely about corruptly. And that would be the case to take up if that's what they're interested in. I think that if they take the Katsas view, those 327 cases go out the window. I don't think they can be salvaged. And there are a lot of people who pled guilty to just that charge, some of whom pled down to that charge, like a lot of the Proud Boy cooperators, the Oath Keeper cooperators. You know, they pled to just that charge or conspiracy to commit that charge. So, yeah, this will be a real, it'll be really bad in the January 6th context.
But I just had one more thing, which is, even though it would not disturb a whole bunch of convictions, including many of the convictions for more serious offenses, and even though in a bunch of the 320 cases Roger mentioned, there'd be other avenues by which the government could go after at least some of these defendants, it will be portrayed by, you know, those who are sympathetic to the January 6th defendants as a categorical repudiation of the entire project in ways that I think are really both dangerous and completely factually lacking, right? It's sort of, you know, maybe the government sort of chose to embrace a reading of a statute that the Supreme Court would later reject, right? That is not per se proof that all of these prosecutions were, you know, ill-motivated witch hunts, right? And yet, I think that's the message. I mean, if you look at how right-wing media is already responding just to the fact that the court granted cert, you know, I think the court has rather kicked a hornet's nest here. And I'm not sure the extent to which the justices fully appreciate that.
And just for people who are not steeped in crim pro stuff, if the government, with all the statutes in the world in front of it, makes a plea deal with you to dismiss everything that you could be charged with, except a statute that then later is interpreted narrowly so as not to include the conduct that you're accused of, is it just the government then shit out of luck on all the other statutes that they could have charged you with that they didn't? Or does it affect the integrity of the larger deal? Or does it matter how the deal was constructed?
I don't know the answer to that question. And what they've typically done is they've charged you with a bunch of crimes, you plead guilty, and then they dismiss the others. I don't know if those are dismissed with prejudice. I assume they were. But I don't know that as a fact, and I haven't come across this fact pattern before.
So, I mean, it happens, you know, it does happen. I mean, there's a federal rule of criminal procedure. It's Rule 32. It used to be Rule 32E. It might have been rewritten that does that. The short version is if a defendant is able to sort of get out from under his plea agreement, Ben, he had the plea agreement has to be withdrawn. And so, right, so it really comes down to, you know, I don't think this is going to be a situation where the government is somehow precluded by double jeopardy from bringing those charges again. I think it just gets us back to square one, where we're back to sort of the government being in its original position, although now without the specter of the 1512 C2 charge. And if you have defendants who are convicted of multiple counts, where 1512 C2 is only one of them, right, there's a bunch of case law about what's supposed to happen then. Ben, usually it's just resentencing, where the question is just, would the sentence have been different had you been convicted of two charges instead of three? So, you know, I don't think the reality is not that a decision in favor of Fisher or in favor of the Katz's view of 1512 C2 would exonerate the however many of the defendants have only 1512 C2 charges, but it would be a massive headache. Because the government would presumably have to go back and bring a bunch of these cases over again, perhaps through other statutes. And, you know, Ben, it's not for nothing that this would now be in the fall of 2024, when, you know, I think the notion that the government's going to be able to move quickly on these is hard to believe. And where by the time those cases actually get to trial or plea deal, it's possible there's a different administration in place.
Right. So before we move on, I know a lot of our listeners and viewers will want to know the answer to this. Steve, your former small group member at Yale Law School, Elmer Stewart Rhodes, I think you're the only one of us who went to school with a January 6th defendant, much less a seditious conspiracy defendant. Would he be affected by this case, or is seditious conspiracy that conviction just blows everything else out of the water? Does he have one of these in his case?
So, you know, I was trying to go back and look. I don't remember if there was a C2 conviction among the many other charges that my small group mate was convicted of. But I mean, all that would entail, Ben, is resentencing. And just to Ben, to go back to where you and I started our friendship, the most recent DC Circuit decision about how vacated convictions affect resentencing is an al-Balul. In the context of the military commissions. And just to be clear, the review is fairly deferential. So, you know, I think the worst case scenario for folks who have been convicted of a bunch of things, including offenses more serious than 1512 C2, is new sentencing hearings that may result in very similar sentences. The cases where this is going to make a huge difference are the cases where it was only 1512 C2.
And Roger, how many of those cases are there? Do we know?
It's not a huge number. That it's true that most will have, you know, assaulted police officers and so on. But there are a number where that's the top charge and the rest are misdemeanors. But I'm more concerned about a lot of people that pled guilty to just this charge. And I don't know exactly, as Steve, I hope Steve's right. But you know, most of these people did nothing to, it's not like they challenged. There's only these three people that challenged this statute. So, or that that's probably not right, but most people haven't challenged. You think that they too would be, the government would be able to go after them and try to bring new charges or restore the ones they dismissed? I don't know about that. Plus, it's so hard to do it. Well, I
So
don't.
I'll say, I mean, the Supreme Court's double jeopardy jurisprudence distinguishes between dismissals for sort of evidentiary reasons and dismissals for non-evidentiary reasons. And so, you know, I don't think the government's going to have a double jeopardy problem in trying to bring charges against folks if this gets thrown out. I think there's going to be messy litigation about whether people who pled guilty can somehow get some kind of collateral relief under 28 U.S.C. Section 2255, whether those whose appeals are still going, right? I mean, it's just, Ben, it's the it's going to, the short version of it is going to be a mess.
Right.
And I suspect that the government's merits brief in the Supreme Court is going to spend at least some time trying to paint a picture for the justices of just how much of a mess this is going to be. Because the way it was briefed at the cert stage was very sort of, I don't want to say perfunctory, Ben, but very sort of like, you know, we'll deal with this later. And the Supreme Court clearly says, no, we're going to deal with this now. Now, and we should just say now probably means, you know, argument in March or April, right, and a decision by June.
All right. So, next Supreme Court issue. Jack Smith decides, and I was annoyed at myself for not thinking of this on his behalf, to do the kind of jump shift and ask the Supreme Court to tell the D.C. Circuit that it doesn't really matter very much, which is, you know, not what the D.C. Circuit ever likes to hear. It seems to me a very smart move on Smith's part, because if he wins, he saves himself however much time the D.C. Circuit would have taken, and time is of the essence for him. And if he loses, he's no worse off than he was, you know, then he has to tell the D.C. Circuit to expedite things, which he kind of has to do anyway. So, Steve, is there more risk to this strategy than I'm perceiving, or is this just the right move for him to have done at this point?
So I think the answer to both questions is yes, right? That there is there's one other risk, but I still think it's the right move. So the other risk is that the court expedites the heck out of this case and then rules for Trump, which, you know, but
that's just getting to where they were going to end up faster. I actually think that's a better outcome than the D.C. Circuit takes some time and the Supreme Court takes some time and then, you know, rules for Trump.
Which is why I think this was the right move. So just 30 seconds on the process here. I mean, I think the, you know, cert before judgment, which is what Smith did, is one piece, but he also asked the court to expedite consideration of the cert petition. And what I was really, again, surprised by was how quickly the court agreed to expedite its consideration. So within like 4 or 5 hours of, you know, Smith's filing hitting the docket, the court had already granted his motion to expedite the briefing so that Trump's response is due next Wednesday. That to me, Ben, is a sign that there's a lot of interest in the court in moving pretty quickly on this. And, you know, by historical standards, this is the kind of case where the court would have moved this quickly. The stakes are not as high as, for example, the Steele seizure case or the Nazi saboteurs or, you know, the Watergate tapes.
Particularly not for the defendants.
No, but you know, if you think, if you're measuring it historically compared to when the court granted cert before judgment in the old days, you could argue it's a bit of a stretch. If you look at the last 4 years where the court has granted cert before judgment been 19 times, you know, in cases that look nowhere near as important as this, in cases that weren't even constitutional cases, I think the argument for the court resolving this sooner rather than later becomes pretty hard to reject. And I've been fascinated by the attempts by folks on the right to portray this as some kind of insidious move. It's like, asking the Supreme Court that has 6 Republican nominees on it to resolve whether former President Trump is immune is somehow insidious. Maybe that's just a point that, like, there's nothing Jack Smith can do that anyone on that side will think is above board.
So I'm curious, and Roger and Anna, you know, jump in on this as well, if you have thoughts. It seems to me like lots of people are saying Trump's claim here is trivial or frivolous. It's an issue of first impression, at least in the sense that we've never indicted a former president who's therefore had to plead it before. On the other hand, you have some real executive power people on that court, and there's no doctrine that says this immunity doesn't exist. And so it seems to me a sort of weird Rorschach test for the court that can't entirely be disaggregated from how they feel about Donald Trump.
It might be helpful to break out the 3 different immunity questions that actually are all mushed into one here.
Sure, go ahead.
So I think the frivolous argument is the argument that because he was acquitted in his second impeachment.
The double jeopardy argument is trivial.
Okay, good. On the question of whether former presidents are immune from criminal prosecution, you know as well as anyone that there are actually two pieces to that. The first is whether the sort of the broad absolute immunity that the court recognized in civil cases in Nixon versus Fitzgerald also applies to the president. And I will say it seems relevant here that the Office of Legal Counsel, which tends to err on the side of the president, thinks the answer is no. But even if it did, you still have the question of whether the particular conduct for which former President Trump has been indicted was within the outer perimeter of his official duties. Because if not, it's outside of Nixon versus Fitzgerald anyway. And so it seems to me that you could very possibly build a coalition of justices to say, we can assume without deciding that the principles underlying Nixon versus Fitzgerald might apply to former presidents, but we don't have to worry about that here because everything that Trump is being indicted for was not within the outer perimeter of his official duties. And so therefore, no immunity either way.
It's funny because I actually think the question of whether the immunity exists is an easier question than the question of the parameters of Nixon v. Fitzgerald. Roger, what do you think? Are you principally anxious about this case to the extent that you're anxious about it because of the time suck it could represent or because of the outcome that it could produce?
It's mainly the time element. I thought the issues as they were briefed and the ruling that came down was extremely strong, and the fact that there are these two OLC decisions that came down in the same direction over the years from different administrations, and I thought it was a very strong ruling. I'm quite concerned about how I don't exactly see how they get to the March 4th trial. It's sort of a question of how much do you have to push it off? Maybe not till after the election, but I think that's a really tough date to still meet at this point because things are backing up all the motions and that were sort of staggered and things like jury questionnaires and just all the preliminaries, the motions in limine, the rulings on SEPA Section 6, it's just a lot to get done by March 4th.
What do you think, Anna? Are you similarly despairing of the March 4th trial date?
Yeah, I don't see any way that the March 4th trial date is still going to happen at this point. The question is just how much it may be delayed. Of course, I've been wrong in the past. I could be wrong before, but I do think that it would be very unlikely to happen at this point. And especially too, I know that Judge Chutkan said that the pretrial deadlines are held in abeyance and that she will reconsider, what to do about the trial date when there's no longer a stay on the case. But I think that any judge is going to be reluctant to, if there's a significant passage of time or even, a few weeks that go by where, there's been no burdens of litigation on the defendant and to then suddenly expect them to immediately be able to meet all the deadlines that they previously, had been kind of paused. I think that if this were not if this were any other defendant other than Trump, I would be thinking to myself that is something that a judge, should not expect of a defendant. And so I think, to be fair to the Trump team here, it also seems to be the case that I don't think they can be expected to kind of just pick back up and not have at least some kind of justifiable reason to argue for a delay since the case has been stayed. So, you know, just my two cents, but I'm really curious. I had to walk away for a second, but Steve, did you say when you thought the earliest that the court would be able to decide if they, you know, do take up this question, and what your estimation would be for the trial date?
I didn't, but you know, it's worth playing this out. So I think the Supreme Court has put itself in a position where it will be able to either grant or deny cert before judgment probably by the end of next week, you know, next Friday, if I had to guess. And I don't think the justices would want this hanging over their heads during the holidays. And if they granted cert before judgment and a next Thursday or Friday, I think they'd want argument in January. You know, I mean, why move this fast just to slow down on the merits? And so I wouldn't be surprised if they grant cert before judgment, and that's an if we had a January argument and a decision from the court by mid-February. Now, I agree with you that even in that universe, which is the Supreme Court moving at lightning speed or even ludicrous speed, if folks remember Spaceballs, there's no way you get to a March 4th trial date, but you do get a trial date sometime next year, right? And you know, a February decision by the Supreme Court, assuming it doesn't say Trump is immune, in which case the trial date becomes a bit of a moot point, you know, I think probably is enough to have a trial date, you know, in June, maybe July. But, you know, that's where the trial lawyers are probably in a better position than I am. The other thing we should throw in here is, you know, it's worth not forgetting the D.C. Circuit in this conversation. So two things that I think ought to be sort of articulated. The first is the reason why Judge Chutkan had to stop is not because of Jack Smith's filing. It's because of Trump's appeal. So, you know, Trump appealed Judge Chutkan's denial of his motion to dismiss to the D.C. Circuit. And then that appeal automatically, right, divests the district court of the ability to keep going, at least on issues related to the scope of the appeal. So, you know, one of the other things that happened right after the Supreme Court started to step in is the D.C. Circuit issued a briefing schedule that has, you know, the Trump's brief due on the 23rd. It has the government's brief due on the 30th. It has the reply brief due January 2nd. And that also, to me, smells like a January argument. So, you know, I think the D.C. Circuit is basically putting itself in a position to also have a January argument if the Supreme Court denies cert before judgment. And then, you know, we could similarly have a ruling by late January, early February. The problem is that if that ruling is the D.C. Circuit, then we get round two in the Supreme Court. And, you know, even if the Supreme Court is willing to let the D.C. Circuit have the last word, I'd be very surprised if it was. That's going to take yet more time to play out.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers.
that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
Yeah, so I am going to be the one who stands up for the March 4th trial deadline, or trial date, and I'm going to do it partly because I'm just contrary, and I want somebody to make the argument for it, and none of you guys did, and some partly because I actually think it's plausible. Look, nobody will say the words here because the judiciary is supposed to be apolitical, and Jack Smith is also supposed to behave apolitically. But there's a very simple reality here, which is the reason the March 4th trial date matters is because of the November election date. Otherwise, we wouldn't really care whether it was March, April, May, June, or next fall. We care because Donald Trump might be the next president, and that would mean this case would end by one means or another. So the Supreme Court's very aware of that, as is everybody else. And these are nine very sophisticated Washington actors. And I think the argument, you know, force them, you know, that they're going to want to resolve this in a way that they do not get blamed for this getting pushed back until after the election. No one will ever mention November as a real date. No one's ever going to mention it as a factor. It's a factor. And so I think whatever they're going to do, they're going to do very quickly. All right, let us move on to everybody's favorite appeals court, the 11th Circuit. And the 11th Circuit has a big oral argument tomorrow. It's in the Fulton County case. Anna, remind us what is going on and why the 11th Circuit is meeting tomorrow to hear oral arguments.
Right. So the oral arguments tomorrow before the 11th Circuit panel are on Mark Meadows' ongoing quest to remove his Fulton County criminal charges to federal court from state court to federal court. Judge Steve Jones in the Northern District of Georgia already heard argument on that motion previously and denied Meadows' request to move his case to federal court. And if folks recall, the statute here at issue has basically three prongs. One is that you have to be a federal officer. The other is that the conduct that is alleged in the indictment has some kind of causal connection or is related to a federal office. And then the third is that you can raise a colorable federal defense against the charges. And Judge Jones, really, in his opinion, denying Meadows' quest for removal, focused on that second prong. So whether or not basically Meadows was acting within the scope of his office, and Meadows has appealed. And we now have this three judge panel of the 11th Circuit. It's Chief Judge Pryor, who is a Bush appointee. And then it is Judge Rosenbaum, who is an Obama appointee, and Judge Abudu, who is the newest member of the 11th Circuit, who was nominated and confirmed by the Senate to the bench, nominated by Biden and then confirmed by the Senate. And so it'll be very interesting. What I'm looking for in terms of listening to these oral arguments is the question of whether this panel might agree with Judge Jones in his reasoning, or if they might end up, you know, agreeing with his ultimate conclusion, but for a different reason. And the reason that I mention that is because we've had previously a question that came down from the emergency stay panel, who asked whether the parties debriefed this question of whether or not the statute, the removal statute, applies to former federal office holders, because of course Meadows here is the former federal officer. So I'm really looking to see if maybe they will take that route. One reason being that there's a case called United States versus Pate that the 11th Circuit recently decided in an en banc decision. And in that decision, they looked at a criminal statute that criminalizes retaliatory liens against any officer or employee of the United States. And they kind of had this similar textualist question of whether, you know, does that just apply to retaliatory liens that are filed against current officers, or does it also apply to people who have left office and then someone files retaliatory liens against them on account of, you know, things that they did while they're in office or on account of their position that they used to hold? And in that decision, Judge Rosenbaum, Judge Abudu, and Judge Pryor were all in the majority. Judge Pryor wrote the decision, and they ended up saying, you know, no, the statute does not apply to former officers. And so they did take that very kind of textualist look at this statute, which could very easily be the same kind of reasoning that they come to here, even though there's different, you know, policy considerations, the language is a little bit different. But it seems to be the case that they could come to, you know, a very similar decision. So Ben, I know we've talked about before how the two of us kind of agreed that it just can't be the case that the removal statute doesn't apply to former federal officers because of the policy reasons at play.
It would defeat the entire purpose of right. the statute.
And so,
I agree.
Right. And so, Steve, I would love to hear your thoughts. And then also, so in my mind, the reason this is significant about if that's the route they go, is because it seems to me that that would be something that would be quite ripe for Supreme Court intervention if there is an appeal, because that just cannot be right. So I thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I've said this all along, although gotten into more trouble than I thought I would, that has to be right. That, you know, the federal officer removal statute was expanded after the Civil War to prevent states from harassing the federal government by going after its officers. It would make no sense to allow states to harass former federal officers and deny them the same protection. And to me, Anna, everything turns on the more sort of, you know, are you being tried because of official federal government acts question? And, you know, again, here, I think Meadows is actually almost a unicorn, because Meadows has the strongest argument that all of the, you know, backroom manipulative stuff he was doing was part of his job, because his job was basically to do Trump's bidding, as opposed to cabinet secretaries or other government officers who have more clearly defined duties.
Yeah, so I agree with you that Meadows has the strongest case. He also has the only plausible case. You know, like, a whole bunch of the others are like, you know, I get removal because I'm a fake elector, you know, and in my capacity as a fake elector, which, by the way, if you were a real elector, that's not a federal office either.
No, but you have to admire the chutzpah of it.
Oh, I love it so very much. All right, so Anna, you are in the Washington Post's cubby at the E. Barrett Prettyman Courthouse because they are considering the Giuliani matter. Give us an update. How much of the trial have you sat through, and what are your impressions?
Yeah, so I planned to be here the whole week, but I unfortunately got sick earlier in the week, so I missed the first 2.5 days of the damages trial. Giuliani, of course, has already been held liable for defamation in default, because he did not comply with his discovery obligations in the case brought by Shea Moss and Ruby Freeman. And in case folks need a reminder of who those women are, not that most people who listen to this podcast probably do, but those are the Georgia election workers in Fulton County during the 2020 election who were the subject of false claims by Giuliani and many others, that they were pulling suitcases full of ballots from underneath the table at the State Farm Arena, and that they changed votes and stuffed ballots in favor of Joe Biden. And they have sued Giuliani, and this has been long ongoing litigation that has culminated in this damages trial. During the course of the week, Shea Moss testified about the impact that Giuliani's false statements had on her and her life. I missed that testimony, but I have heard from those who were here to watch it that it was a very impactful testimony and very moving at times. I was here to watch Ruby Freeman's testimony yesterday, which was similarly tearful and moving. Someone has a question, I believe, in the Q&A, so maybe I'll just go ahead and mention it now because it kind of relates. Auntie, do you want to go ahead and ask that question so that I can discuss a little bit?
Yeah. So how dramatic an impact do you think video and other recordings have been in the defamation trial? And do you think it's likely that the jury will send a message? Thanks.
Yeah, so thanks for bringing this up. The reason I wanted you to ask it now, because I think that it's a really good point, and it's something I've been thinking about as I've been watching Ruby Freeman testify. Giuliani was supposed to testify today, but he did not end up doing so. But one of the things that was kind of the most emotionally really affecting moments of yesterday was seeing in the exhibits, which people are not able to see if through the, you know, written reporting on the case, but we were able to see in the media room, in the courtroom. But you see these exhibits of the dozens of hateful emails and death threats that Ruby Freeman and Shamos received. You listen to the voicemails that they received that are racist, that are, you know, threatening them with things that are just unspeakable.
Yeah, just to be clear, these are not garden variety, you know, racist taunts. These are like, please, you know, please commit suicide so you can spare us the ammunition. We're going to hang you from the Capitol Dome, and I want to be close enough to hear your neck snap. I mean, this is, you know, the real deal.
Yeah, it's thing, and I, you know, I don't want to go into it too much, but people can go and, you know, read the on Twitter, I was posting some of it yesterday, but it's really awful, grotesque stuff that it makes you, because I think with January 6 cases and the Trump cases in general, people tend to talk about them as, you know, the victims are democracy itself, which is true, but, you know, there are also real human victims, and these women, you know, seeing them testify, it was already something that I knew, that their lives were torn apart by what happened to them during the 2020 election, but it was something that you really kind of see the gravity of it, and you really kind of just, it's tough to listen to. I know that it was from, you know, the way that they were presenting on the stand, it with, you know, crying, it was very hard for them to get through testimony. I know that it was very difficult for them, and so you just really, you know, put the kind of human face to, you know, the harm of what happened during the 2020 election. And it gave a, you know, also a preview of these are folks who are expected to be witnesses and you know, very important witnesses in the upcoming Fulton County case. A lot of those charges relate to, you know, pressure campaigns against Ruby Freeman. In fact, today, one of the individuals who was charged with that alleged pressure campaign against Ruby Freeman showed up to watch the trial. That's Harrison Floyd, who's one of Trump's co-defendants in Fulton County. So it really has been an interesting experience. And, you know, there's not a whole lot of new information, but it's something that I think that in the Fulton County case, I feel I'm very glad that there is the live streaming and public access to that, because, you know, in federal court, it's seeing that video and hearing that audio and listening to that testimony. It's something that I think reporting it out through the written word just doesn't really do justice to. And in terms of whether or not the jury will send a message, sorry, I want to move on, but I don't know. I was not here when the expert witness testified about, you know, the damages, the reputational harm. So I'm not sure that I can really speak to what they might do or how they might have judged that witness. I do think that the closing statements from Freeman and Moss's attorney was very powerful, and I could very well see, you know, the punitive damages being significant, and maybe they will send a message, but I really just at this point am unsure what, you know, I can't put a number amount to it. So we will see.
All right. We are going to go to audience questions, folks. Richard Wattenbarger, the floor is yours.
I guess I picked a good day since Steve Vladek's here, so maybe this is in his wheelhouse. But I've seen some discussion that the Supreme Court's rulings on the use of executive power has been inconsistent between the Trump and Biden administrations. And one thing I have in mind are the case such as the student loan forgiveness one. So I realize there's a point in which one ends up comparing apples and oranges as far as the actual cases that come before the court are concerned. Are these concerns about the court's consistency warranted And should that raise additional concerns with respect to any Trump cases that the court will rule on?
Steve, if you want to take a first crack at that.
So I think it might be helpful to focus on three different categories of cases. So on sort of pure like constitutional executive power cases, I actually think the court has been fairly consistent. The court likes executive power, and especially likes presidential power. And that's been true really for most of the last 10 years, but especially since Justice Kavanaugh was confirmed in 2018. There aren't that many of those cases, and they tend to show up in sort of nerdy spaces like firing patent judges. But at least there, I think the court has been pretty consistent. The second category of cases is executive branch policies and whether they're authorized by the underlying statutes. So that's like the student loan cases. That's a bunch of immigration cases. And I think there probably is at least something to the charge that the court has been more skeptical of Biden administration arguments about what statutes like the HEROES Act authorize than it was about Trump administration arguments in cases like the travel ban case. Some of that, though, might also reflect that the court is hardening around a new doctrine, the major questions doctrine, that should disempower administrative agencies across any administration, and that really hadn't happened until very, very, very late in the Trump administration. So, yes, I think there's inconsistency there. The third category of cases are cases about Trump himself. And, you know, one of the things that I think we don't talk about enough is that Trump's actual track record before the Supreme Court in cases about him is terrible.
Yeah, not good.
Right. And the court has actually, I think to its credit, really resisted the temptation to side with Trump in, for example, the subpoena cases, in Mazars, in the NARA documents dispute last January. I mean, like, you know, there isn't any one of those cases where Trump has won. And so I think, you know, where the court is being inconsistent is when it comes to executive branch policies. But when it comes to constitutional questions of executive power or, you know, personal misconduct by Trump, the court's actually been consistent. And at least in the latter category, I have problems with the former. To my mind, pretty good.
All right. Jeff asks, if Trump gets convicted in his January 6th trial before the election, will that cause a flood of 14th Amendment challenges to him being on the ballot? I will take a crack at this and see if any of you disagree with me. The 14th Amendment Section 3 does not specify that the threshold for disqualification is conviction of the crime of insurrection or a crime involving a fact pattern of insurrection. The threshold is, did you take the oath and did you engage in insurrection? That's more of an empirical question. And so I don't think, honestly, that it should turn on whether he's convicted. Whether it might, because the argument that he did engage is way more powerful if a jury of his peers has convicted him of it, I don't know. My guess is the Supreme Court is going to have something to say about the meaning of Section 3 that will maybe carry us through that. But
God, I hope not.
It's certainly possible that the case for it will look a whole lot better if he's convicted. What do you guys think?
Can I just say two quick things, and then I'd love to hear Roger and Anna's thoughts?
Yeah.
So really quickly, first, I mean, it's worth remembering that there are criminal statutes where one of the consequences of conviction is automatic disqualification, and none of those statutes are in the indictment against former President Trump. So, you know, you'd have a pretty good argument actually in the other direction that these are not the kinds of criminal statutes that bring with them automatic disqualification. The second point is more atmospheric, but, contra the Supreme Court's apparent interest in the immunity question and its apparent interest in the 1512C2 question, I don't think the court wants anything to do with the Section 3 question.
So you think they'll just let him be knocked off the ballot?
I think they're hoping against hope that no state court actually keeps him off the ballot. They'll have to take it up if someone does. But if, you know, but if Colorado says actually Trump can be on the ballot, if Minnesota says Trump can be on the ballot, I think the court wants to avoid that, because, Ben, there are two terrible alternatives, right? One is the Supreme Court stopping him from running for office, and the other is the Supreme Court not stopping him from running for office, at which point turns around and says the Supreme Court exonerated him.
What do you think, Roger? You've been following the Section 3 cases with the same neurotic intensity that you've been following January 6th, 1512 C2 cases. Do you think, A, the Supreme Court is going to be muscled into this area, and B, that there's a material difference in how the question plays out if you have a conviction for insurrectionary-like behavior that federal prosecutors don't call insurrection?
Well, I'm really hoping this gets sorted out and decided earlier than that. I mean, if we are, you know, still at the, you know, months from now, and these are live questions, that's going to be a terrible situation. I'm really hoping that the Colorado case will give the court an opportunity to take this up and just decide it and get this behind us. Unfortunately, I don't see that happen, because there's a lot of cases where people are kicking the can down the road, and for good reasons. But, you know, the case for keeping somebody off a primary ballot is much weaker than keeping somebody off the general election ballot, because usually the primary is controlled by the political party. And if they want to run a disqualified person, so be it. The Secretary of State often doesn't have a say, but you just keep getting further and further to this train wreck. And I think the questioner is right that, yeah, this will give added impetus, especially as the evidence comes in. And, you know, a lot of the cases now are based on the January 6th report. This additional evidence is just more and more, you know, it's just overwhelming. There was an insurrection. He did participate in it. And what are you going to do about it? And somebody needs to decide these questions.
Yeah, so I will just say on this point that I could not agree more with Roger. You can, as the Minnesota Supreme Court did, do a technical dodge of this question. And it may be in some very formal way an exercise in judicial restraint. But what it really is it's kicking the can down the road to the point where there's an actual crisis. And just a reminder, you know, when you're dealing with Congress, somebody elected to Congress or to the Senate, there's this other mechanism other than a judge saying you can't, you know, you're disqualified, which is that the Congress can refuse to seat the member, which, by the way, has happened a lot of times. And so Congress, in fact, one of the arguments about Section 3 is that Congress is, at least in congressional cases, has the exclusive authority to implement Section 3. Not sure I think that's right, but it certainly has the authority. Here, you don't have anything like that. If you put Donald Trump on the ballot and he's not constitutionally qualified to be president, there's no other mechanism. It's not like, you know, on Inauguration Day, the Chief Justice is going to be like, nope, sorry, can't administer the oath. You're constitutionally ineligible. And if he did that, it would be perfectly reasonable for Trump to sweep him aside and say, okay, Clarence Thomas, come administer the oath. You know, and so if you're on the ballot and the electors elect you and you're not qualified, it's not clear that there's another enforcement mechanism for this. And so I just think it's like too clever by half for the courts to avoid this question, and they should answer it sooner rather than later.
I'll just say that I'll just say like the end of the movie War Games, sometimes the only winning move is not to play.
Agreed. That is, if you were giving political advice to John Roberts, that would be the political advice that you would give him. But I'm talking about doing the right thing, Steve.
Have you met the Supreme Court of the United States?
Simon, you have the penultimate question today.
Thanks very much. I'm wondering if you could update me on the status of Rudy Giuliani's apparently many and varied legal problems, I guess other than the ones that Anna Bauer was updating us about today. How many felony charges is he facing, and in which courts? Do we know how many cases he appears to be an unindicted co-conspirator in? And what about the various disciplinary proceedings and civil suits that he's involved in? I'm trying to wrap my head around what that man's world looks like right now. Thank you.
Yep. So I can give you a little bit of a rundown. Anna, I'm going to miss stuff, so, you know, chime in. He's got a bunch of felony counts in Fulton County, Georgia. He is named as an unindicted co-conspirator in the federal case against Trump. And as all of the unindicted co-conspirators in that case, he remains unindicted. Not clear to me that he will remain unindicted. I think there's some point at which the unindicted co-conspirators are going to likely be indicted. At least that's my instinct. He has bar disciplinary proceedings in New York and in Washington, and he has a variety of civil suits, including the one we discussed today. Those are the matters that are coming to my mind. Anna, do you have more Rudy woes that I'm not thinking of?
No, I think that you pretty much covered it. Did you? You said bar proceedings, that there's a decision pending in D.C. about, because his license is suspended, but there hasn't been a determination as to his disbarment, as I understand it.
D.C. and New York also, I think. Yeah. Yeah.
All right, Joyce.
I'm looking forward to next week's argument where Trump's team is going to twist themselves into a pretzel to explain to the Supreme Court why they don't want to take up the immunity claim on his behalf. And I'm wondering if Smith will ever put it out there on the public record that if Trump believes, truly believes, that all this is a witch hunt and that he's an innocent victim of a purely political prosecution, why wouldn't he want his day in court as quickly as possible so he could prove his innocence?
Steve, do you want to wrap us up with this one?
Internal consistency has never been a hallmark of legal filings on behalf of former President Trump. But I will just say, I am not only looking forward to reading President Trump's brief in opposition, I am really looking forward to reading Jack Smith's reply. Because for those who sort of, you know, I speak here from a little bit of experience, the best brief to write, the most fun brief to write in the Supreme Court is the cert stage reply brief, because you only get 3,000 words. And so you have to be both like pithy and memorable. And I think, you know, I think Smith is going to have some fun pointing out all the ways in which the arguments I suspect we'll get from former President Trump don't really augur against the Supreme Court's intervention.
I think he waived that brief.
So he waived the 14-day waiting period. So this is nerdy Supreme Court procedure. So usually there's a 14-day waiting period after a brief in opposition is filed before the case will be distributed. He waived the 14-day waiting period so that the court can move as quickly as possible. I'm sure he is still going to file a reply.
We are going to leave it on that note of certainty. From France, Roger Parloff. From Washington, D.C., Anna Bauer. From Austin, Texas, Steve Vladek. And from The Hague, it's Ben Wittes. Thank you all for joining us today from four different jurisdictions. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a material supporter through our website, lawfaremedia.org/support. You'll also be able to pose questions to our panel and become part of the discussion by joining our Zoom webinars, available only to our supporters. It is time for Lawfare's end of the year mailbag. Submit questions to lawfaremedia.org/article/ Mailbag 2023. This podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell. Your audio engineer this episode was Anna Hickey of Lawfare. Our music is, of course, performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.